This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you don't think that Mitch McConnell would do that in a heartbeat and just look at you dead in the eye while doing it? So the Democrats don't have the killer instinct in the same way. I am not 100% sure what it's going to take, but I think we have to continue to push them on it, and then maybe they'll see that this other side has no good faith at all, and not only that, they've got a shiv they're ready to stick in our back.
The new American majority is multiracial, multicultural, and progressive, and our guest today is working to make sure that it also has a powerful voice in shaping the future of politics in this country. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Steve Phillips, author, political activist, and founder of Democracy in Color. We discuss Georgia's important role in the 2020 election, talk about his friendship with Stacey Abrams, and contemplate potential Democratic strategies in other racially, ethnically, and politically diverse states such as Arizona, North Carolina, and Texas. Lastly, we dive into the Senate, scrutinizing Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's latest shenanigans and discussing the future of the filibuster. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Steve Phillips. He's the host of Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. He's also the founder of Democracy in Color and a regular opinion contributor to the New York Times and a columnist for The Nation. His last book is called Brown is the New White. Steve, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, congratulations. I think we all are indebted to the work that you and your colleagues did, especially in Georgia. And taking back the Senate. We had you on about a year ago, and I believe the title of the episode was How Democrats Take the Senate. I don't think this was the roadmap that either you or I or many people had guessed was how Democrats were going to take the Senate, was through a miraculous Georgia runoff, but it seems like it worked out.
Yeah, no, it definitely was not the first path or the path of least resistance. And I frankly had forgotten, actually, that they, even the other seat, the one that Ossoff won, had to go to a runoff as well. Georgia has this, arcane law around runoffs, which was set up to be able to dilute the African-American vote. So there's a lot of historical irony that you had somebody who worked for a civil rights legend and the successor to Martin Luther King winning those races. But It was definitely quite gratifying, exciting, and a really, really, very satisfying outcome.
This was many years in the making. You met with Stacey Abrams years ago, and you saw her presentation when she was, I think, a House Minority Leader in the State Assembly of Georgia, and you were impressed by that. Why don't you kind of walk us through a little bit of your personal history and Stacey Abrams' work there and kind of give us an inside view on the blood, sweat, and tears that went into this most recent victory?
Yeah, I didn't actually even realize how long it had been until the first email I got from Stacey was almost 10 years to the day from the Georgia runoff. It was like January 3rd or something in 2011. And so we have a mutual friend, Ben Jalos, who used to be the president of NAACP. And Ben has known Stacey since they were in their 20s. And so they did some like leadership development work together back at that point in time. And so he did an introduction to me and Stacey saying, there's this great, leader in Georgia and hope you can help her and connect with her and hear what she has to say and try to open some doors for her. And it's just very interesting. The very first email, she says, we have a path in Georgia, but it will take careful planning. And I think that really has been the hallmark of Stacey's work. So when I first met with her, she brought me a 28-page PowerPoint around how they were going to turn Georgia. and it was very detailed, data-driven and detailed in terms of really looking at the demographics, the people of color population, the non-voting people of color population, where that population was in different counties and different state legislative districts. And it was a multi-year plan. Like, so that first plan was a six-year plan around how they're going to make increases within the state house. So just the level of data, discipline, detail was quite distinctive and unusual of what I've seen in national politics. And it really showed a sophistication and a long-term commitment and a savvy that really led me to get behind her and to try to connect her up and let the people who I knew out there know about her to try to get additional support for their work there.
How is Georgia unique? What did we learn?
What hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but some, is that there were significant increases in both Latino and Asian American vote within Georgia. But the foundation and what really made it clear that what was possible was increasing the turnout of voters of color and building the civic engagement infrastructure to be able to do that work. So Stacey created this organization, New Georgia Project, recruited this woman, Nse Ufa, to come run it. And so we did an interview with Nse on our podcast on the beginning of January. And they set about trying to hire up staff, organize volunteers in every county within the state of Georgia, 156 counties, I believe. Ultimately, they've hired 3,000 people and registered 500,000 people to vote. So raising the floor of the number of people of color and African Americans in particular made so much more possible. So Stacey, even in her 2018 election, so Obama lost Georgia by 200,000 votes, 215,000, I believe, when he ran in 2008, without even contesting the state. It came within 5 percentage points, put nothing into it. Similarly to the way Biden put nothing into it. Stacey, by steadily increasing the turnout, she came within 50,000 votes. Biden won by 12,000 votes. And so the foundation of all of that has been increasing the voters of color. And so Stacey got more votes in 2018 than any Democrat who has ever run for office in Georgia in the history of the country, more than Jimmy Carter, more than Obama had gotten, more than anybody. And that was through the increased voter turnout piece. Now, we've seen that the Republicans have also turned out to try to block a black woman becoming governor, to try to keep a white nationalist in the White House. And what it was that foundation, all that infrastructure, all those different volunteers, organizers, and activists who brought it so close to be able to be within reach. And then there were some white suburbanites who were appalled by Trump, who did defect over to support Biden. And so that was helpful as well, but they would not have been meaningful had we not raised the floor with the turnout of the voters of color.
And I think one of the reasons why it was so surprising that Ossoff and Warnock won, from my perspective, was Kemp was such a, I mean, that race against Stacey Abrams was really just hideous. It was, I mean, this was a ruthless, kind of an abortion of democracy in many ways. This was the Secretary of State who was supposed to oversee his own election in a very tight race and throwing out votes. But in the end, pretty surprising to see that Kemp and Raffensperger didn't go along with what we thought was unfortunately not that out of the realm of possibility, that they would go along with Trump and throw out votes and fix it for their guy.
Yeah, no, I was quite pleasantly surprised to see that the significance of Georgia and the significance of Arizona is that it complicated the attempt to overthrow the election. If the whole election had come down to like Pennsylvania,
right,
they would have brought the full force of everything they could have, and they tried to do in Michigan, getting people from the elections council, the state legislature, to come to the White House to talk about throwing out the votes. But no one of those states was enough.
You mentioned that Obama lost in 2008 by 5% without really investing significantly in the state. He won North Carolina, I think it was it 2008, he won North Carolina. We saw Virginia switch from being a purple state to a blue state over the last decade plus, starting with Obama. because it was that was an important swing state in both 2008 and 2012, and Biden didn't really have to put a lot of resources into Virginia. What happened in North Carolina? Why has that state kind of backslid? We have a Democratic governor in North Carolina, so one would think from afar that it would be going in the same trend as a Georgia or a Arizona. And it still was very close, obviously.
Right. And it was close. Obama won it narrowly in 2008, lost it narrowly in 2012. Mm-hmm. But it has certainly probably the most well-funded, but also the most unashamed, aggressive retrenchment, anti-democratic backlash of any state in the country. And so they have been so aggressive about passing voter suppression laws and doing gerrymandering and doing everything they possibly could to undermine and to weaken the political potential. And then they were very well funded. So again, goes Art Pope, I believe, was this guy, very wealthy, very right-wing donor, underwrote all these different type of efforts. And so in a lot of ways, they're further along in their suppression than other places are. And we haven't had yet the same kind of infrastructure, leadership that we've had in places like Georgia and Virginia, right? New Virginia majority of people like Tram Nguyen have driven the work there over the course of a decade. And that's the kind of leadership that's only now coming into being in Arizona in North Carolina in a similar kind of way.
She was a fast machine, she kept the motor clean. She was the best damn woman that I've ever seen. She had the sightless eyes telling me no lies, knocking me out with those American thighs, taking more than a shot, had me fighting for air. Told me to come, but I was already there, cause the walls were shaking, the earth was quaking, my mind was aching, and we were making love and you shook me
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Steve Phillips. He's the founder of Democracy in Color. So we were talking about North Carolina and its entrenched voter suppressive activities there. Turning to Texas for a moment, that's kind of the holy grail for Democrats through the last few election cycles, and it's fallen short. There are some pretty exciting candidates that have come out of the state, but there are a decade plus of very pernicious rules in place and people in power to try to keep voter registration numbers low and to keep turnout low. How can we use the template of Georgia and apply that to Texas when there are so many barriers to overcome there, Steve?
Yeah, so I'm actually working on a piece for The Nation that should be out either or this week or next around how Texas really is the next Georgia. And I've been analyzing this, and I'm actually doing this for the next book that I'm writing around, looking at what are the lessons from the places that have had success, Virginia, Arizona, Georgia. And there's at least three core elements that you need to have. And so one is favorable demographic terrain. Two is what I'm calling, borrowing from the writer, or stealing from the writer Jim Collins, wrote the book Good to Great, but level five leaders, people who have this personal humility, but this tremendous drive to sacrifice and be able to work for the cause. And then third is strong civic engagement infrastructure. So Georgia had all of that with the demographic trends. You know, Obama lost by 200,000. There were 800,000 people of color who didn't vote. You have Stacey Abrams, New Georgia Project, and other organizations. Texas has those elements. And so there's an organization, Texas Organizing Project, which has been doing this work for almost over a decade now around trying to do similar type of civic engagement, community-based work. And then the political terrain. Texas has far more potential than even Georgia. And so Trump won Texas by 600,000 votes. there were 4.5 million people of color who didn't vote. Beto, in his Senate race, 2018, lost Texas by 200,000 votes, roughly. There were 5.5 million people of color who didn't vote in that race. So the numbers are there if you have the leadership and the organizations and also the funding. That's the other piece about it. When I first worked with Stacey, I helped to raise money to get her funding. She raised $54,000 for her PAC in 2012.
And then how about in this last cycle? It must have been off the charts.
$90 million.
Wow.
But you see what she did with it. She saved the democracy and the planet.
Yeah, it was money well spent for sure.
Yes. So similarly, are we going to invest in a place like Texas on a commensurate level? Because as we're seeing in Georgia, the payoff can be huge. But I really believe that Texas is in the middle of this transformation. And then people don't realize that the turnout was historic all around. And so Biden got more votes in Texas than Trump got in 2016.
Yeah, so the turnout was really impressive. And we've always said, like, Texas is not a blue or red state. It's a non-voting state.
Right.
But that finally got flipped, and yet we still saw Trump hold that state narrowly.
Right, but that's, I think, also the lesson of Georgia, is that clearly, if we don't know anything now, that there is a fanatical cult around Trump that produces these visceral reactions and this visceral voter turnout. So the fact of everything that's happened, you know, at that time, 300,000 deaths from COVID, the complete mismanagement and disinterest in dealing with the pandemic, the fact that Trump got 10 million more votes after even losing some of these white suburban votes is not a positive commentary on our society, but it shows the number of people who care so desperately and passionately about what Joy Reid calls the demographic panic. But what we saw in the runoff in Georgia is that when Trump is not on the ballot, they don't have that same level of turnout. And so that's the prospect and the potential for Texas, is that 2022 is not going to be about getting Trump's back the way that it has been. It's going to be about who should be the gubernatorial candidate. I mean, Beto might run. It's going to be about Beto, or it's going to be about Greg Abbott, right, who's overseen really the defense of the white nationalism in Texas. So the prospects are much more promising, and particularly without Trump on the ballot.
So, Steve, let's turn to the Senate, where we have Mitch McConnell just desperately clinging to power despite now being in the minority. We see that the left is pushing for killing the filibuster. I'm not surprised to see that it's not picking up a lot of steam in the early stages here. I don't think the Senate Democrats were going to kill the filibuster just willy-nilly as a power grab to begin the year. I think they need a pretext to do it. Do you agree?
Well, it's going to take something, although the fact that we're, you know, weeks removed from the second attack on the United States Capitol in 200 years and the attempted murder of the Vice President of the United States, that has not moved them, right?
Right, so, right. Yeah, that's not egregious enough, apparently.
Right. So, but it is notable that, and I'm actually, you know, working on this on a next book around looking at how the South never surrendered in the Civil War, and that, and so looking at how do we actually win the Civil War. So, doing a lot of research around post-Civil War, and around Reconstruction, et cetera, and you had a very similar situation where there was this impulse towards accommodation and compromise with the people who had just committed treason and sedition and insurrection. And what that led to was them getting re-entrenched in power. So if you properly understand the lessons of history, and frankly, if you just look at how the Republicans have operated in the past decade, you would move rapidly. You would pass D.C. statehood to get two more black senators. You would pass the Voting Rights Act. You would get rid of the filibuster. And not only that, you would expand the Supreme Court, right? I didn't know two things until RBG died, that the Supreme Court has changed size 7 or 8 times in U.S. history, and all it takes is a vote of Congress. They could expand the Supreme Court to 13 people tomorrow, and then you put on 4 more people, and there you go. And if you don't think that Mitch McConnell would do that in a heartbeat and just look at you dead in the eye while doing it. So the Democrats don't have the killer instinct in the same way. I am not 100% sure what it's going to take, but I think we have to continue to push them on it, and then maybe they'll see that this other side has no good faith at all. And not only that, they've got a, you know, a shiv they're ready to stick in our back.
After closing time at the country fair, I detect the El Supremo in the room at the top of the stairs. Well, I've been around the world, and I've been in Washington too. And in all my travels, the facts unravel, I found this to be true. Well, poor people sleeping with the shade on the light. Poor people sleeping on the stars coming out at night. Poor people sleeping with the shade on the light. Poor people sleeping on the stars coming out at night.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Steve Phillips. He's the founder of Democracy in Color. So, Steve, we're talking about the filibuster. The problems with the quote-unquote moderate Democrats like West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, to me that they seem like manageable problems. Like, these are people still within your party. They may put out press releases saying it's not open for discussion, they're against it, but I think that that's probably a fib. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's interesting with Sinema in particular, who actually used to be a progressive. When she was a state legislator, she was far more progressive, and that was her identity. And then she's really kind of drunk this Kool-Aid about the way that she's become successful by being moderate. So, and then people kind of, you know, revel in their status as the, you know, the linchpin person or the person who can undo the coalition or whatever. So she's really deep in that. It's a good question. There's also a point, I mean, there is the question around both the pandemic and then the economic crisis that's attendant to it, is can you bring enough pressure on these people to say and to show that people's lives are dramatically impacted and are at stake here? Your constituents' lives are really impacted. And then these Republicans with whom you're over there playing footsie don't give a damn. And so, but I do think ultimately it has to do with a lot. There needs to be strong pressure from progressives from the left to continue to make it painful for them and to try to explain and impact public opinion so that they are seen more as standing in the way of helping people than as some kind of, you know, that in their mind is like standing for principle against the mob or whatnot. When in reality, they're standing in the way of relief to people who are suffering through a pandemic.
That, and I think McConnell may have read the room wrong. He has gone and tried to make this power play right from the get-go, and it seems short-sighted to me, which is, I always think of him as somebody who's playing 3D chess and is looking at the long play here, and that's how he's always viewed in profiles, that he's a really sneaky, wily coyote. But I can't help but think that these calls of unity will not ring through the halls of the White House very effectively as Mitch McConnell tries to drag things out indefinitely here in the Senate. Do you think this is a savvy play by him?
Well, I mean, it's certainly something they're deeply used to, right? It was this, you know, beginning of Obama administration. My goal is to make him a one-term president, right? I believe Obama says in his book, right? They were trying to explain something to McConnell. McConnell's like, you're under the impression that I care.
Right.
So it does seem like for all the talk around, you know, unity and bipartisanship, et cetera, that Biden was putting out on the campaign trail, and I do think is his more core instinct. Plus, I think anybody who gets elected president has so much, you know, ego that they feel they can bend the world to their will, and despite all the obvious evidence that that's not possible. But I have to say the things that they've rolled out in their initial steps have been more clear-eyed about the nature of the opposition than I had feared. And
so what's the wish list for Steve Phillips and the progressive wing of the party for the next, I don't like the 100 days random thing, let's say this year? Maybe you can kind of highlight some of the key issues we should be following moving ahead.
Yeah, I think, again, if you understand this moment in history, that it's not any accident. Well, there's two things, three things are in it. It's not any accident that Obama was elected when he was elected. I'm actually went back and reran the numbers. Obama would not have defeated Reagan, that the country was not diverse enough. If you take 80% of people of color and, you know, the 43% of whites that Obama got in his first run, 39 in the second run, that wouldn't have been enough to beat Reagan. So the country's demographic revolution is what made the conditions possible for Obama to get elected. And then it's not any accident that Trump was elected after the first black president. And so you had this clear backlash. And if that was not clear to people, a marauding mob going through the nation's capital carrying the Confederate flag made it pretty clear. So we are still engaged in this fundamental fight over, is this a predominantly white country or is this a multiracial democracy? And so that has implications in terms of the policy agenda and then really being able to secure our wins and govern in a way that builds the power of the new American majority and delivers on those top concerns and those type of issues. All right, so one is the Voting Rights Act. I mean, that's what they've always gone after. Another is immigration, right? And that was core to Trump's popularity, Trump's identity, which is really, you know, very, very thin code for this is a white country. And I've been glad to see that Biden's move forward on that. But how hard are the Democrats going to fight for a path to citizenship, which is not only the right thing to do, but it continues to diversify the composition of the country and ultimately the electorate. And then third is the issue of the racial reckoning, right? I mean, I think there was a tactical pause in the volume of the demands around Black Lives Matter in 2020, but the underlying conditions haven't changed. The racial wealth gap is still quite, you know, a huge, you know, yawning chasm. And so are they going to lift up those issues? And then Biden, in a way, can do more about racial justice than a black president could. And the same way, like, the thing about Nixon going to China. Is there going to be a high-profile initiative or commission or something along the lines of truth and reconciliation that educates the country and that also delivers a policy agenda that gets at this lasting and fundamental racial wealth gap?
Steve Phillips is the host of Democracy in Color podcast and the founder of Democracy in Color. Steve, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on. Enjoyed it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ramsey Lewis, Bing Ji Ling, and Ricky Lee Jones.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.